يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis with our consultant, lawyer and political expert in the region of the Middle East, Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, James. Getting ready to fly out again soon, so there's always the element of stress and preparation that creeps in, but I'm fine.
Now, I was going to say, actually, you brought that in nicely, that you are visiting the region. We'll go on to that to some extent, but Libya, what is the current situation?
Well, it's very interesting what is happening in Libya. After Tunisia and Egypt, we thought that this is going to be a fast-moving, quick-paced revolution in the Arab world. Everybody was talking about an Arab Spring. But unfortunately, what has happened in Libya is that there is almost the beginnings of a stalemate or even the beginnings of a civil war in the country, where you have the pro-Colonel Gaddafi forces fighting against the rebels, and the country is almost divided into two halves. The eastern half is under the control, more or less, of the anti-Gaddafi forces, whereas the west, and particularly the capital Tripoli and some of his strongholds, such as Sirte, for instance, which is his birthplace as well, are still very much under his control. And what is happening today is a lot of fighting about who controls what territory, offensives and counteroffensives, and it's a pretty bloody situation at the moment.
There's claim and counterclaim as to who's holding which aspects, and as you've said, east and west is fair. You know, you can make some sweeping strokes about who's in charge there, but you look at the Gaddafi rhetoric, which might be a risk in itself, and he does seem to be sounding a little bit more defensive, as in maybe the end is nigh, when he's saying, for instance, Europe will be flooded by thousands of immigrants, you know, if he's ousted, and that sort of language.
Well, he's been saying that. He's been using every single pretext in the book in order to frighten the world into supporting him and his methods of putting down the rebellion in his country. It's interesting because first he called the people who had risen up against him as a bunch of thugs, as a bunch of drug-induced rebels. Then he talked about Al-Qaeda being behind this whole movement to unsettle Libya. Now he's talking about the waves of emigrants and refugees swamping the European shores. And of course, Italy is a good example of that happening, particularly in Lampedusa and other areas of Italy. However, I think there is an offensive defensive side to Colonel Gaddafi. He is, at the best of times, rather unpredictable. And in a sense, although he's defensive because he feels that the situation is not under his control, and there are even rumors circulating that there might be some sort of a negotiation for an exit out of the country for him and his family, and that might become clearer in the next hours or days. But on the other hand, I think he's also a little bit of has a stronger hand, because he actually has managed to rally his forces, whereas at the beginning he was completely taken aback by what had happened and he was relying on vacuous rhetoric. At the moment, his counteroffensive and the attacks being done by his aircraft and by his forces against the rebels is frightening. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen it on their TV news channels. So in a sense, he's in a difficult situation. I still, for some reason, I'm not a betting man, but if I were to go out on a limb, I would say that I can't really see him being involved in any post-rebellion area in Libya, but time will tell whether I'm right or wrong.
Now, the thing with Gaddafi and his rhetoric, he's also using terms like there will be a jihad in the Mediterranean and so forth. So he's not daft. He understands that this is a media issue as well, that this is spreading around the world very quickly, and his words will be carried very quickly, particularly online, to all far-flung corners of the globe. Is he trying to scare the world at large as to, if you don't support me, goodness only knows what will happen?
I think he is trying to scare people more than actually reflecting a reality on the ground. This whole jihadist movement, this whole idea that the country is going to be swamped by Islamist proponents who would then work against the West and all the interests of the West. And remember that Libya is one of the largest oil exporters in the region. So oil is an absolutely important asset in this whole equation. So in that sense, I think there are scaremongering tactics that he is using. But I think both the West, as well as the Arab League, as well as the African organization, as well as the Islamic organization, as well as the Libyan people themselves, have realized at this stage that he's basically bluffing. Now, he's bluffing, but he's bluffing with military support as well that he still has. And therefore, his bluff becomes dangerous. If he were just talking for the sake of talking nonsense, then you would say, okay, it's time for him to pack his bags and leave. But he has still part of the army and the military behind him. And that what makes his threats dangerous, not in the sense that they might necessarily happen tomorrow, but in the sense that if he believes in them or promotes them, then he has still the means to inflict a lot of wounds on the country as a whole.
Now, I don't want to talk about US-UK foreign policy, even when we all know in the Middle East that it's been a difficult situation.
It has been.
Policies of containment.
We here in this country have also had a few awkward incidents with Libya and the Middle East during these moving times.
Well, absolutely. Well, let's just look at it from the perspective of potential foreign military intervention. And at this stage, what's being talked about, of course, is a no-fly zone. What's your opinion on that? Will that happen? And if so, will that protect the people from Gaddafi's airships?
Well, again, James, it's a very difficult question to ask. No-fly zones were applied in Iraq during the sanctions period. It was also a fact during the Kosovo War. The rumors are, and I don't have any source for this, is that some European countries and France and the UK have been mentioned are negotiating a no-fly zone over Libya as well. But it is not as easy as that. As the American Minister of Defense, Robert Gates, said it, and as many, many analysts have said it, applying a no-fly zone is not simply saying we are not going to allow any aircraft to fly over Libyan territory. To do that, what you need to do is to first go and destroy all the radar systems, all the anti-aircraft installations that are on the ground in Libya, in order to be able then to enforce physically a no-fly zone. And imagine one apocalyptic scenario. If Colonel Gaddafi and his people were to suddenly bring human shields around all those radar systems and installations, what would we do then in the West? Surely we're not going to go and bomb the installations and the people out in order to implement a no-fly zone. So it's a dangerous situation. Yes, it's one of the things that the West is trying to do, other than freezing his assets, other than upping the rhetoric, other than imposing economic sanctions, other than even talking of military intervention as President Obama did. But I think we also in the West have had some very awkward moments in the Middle East, and we have seen that the result of any military action might actually be counterproductive for our interests, let alone the interests of the region as a whole. So I caution people, I pray for wisdom, and I hope that before we become too gung-ho about it, we think a little bit more strategically rather than just react tactically.
You mentioned civil war earlier. Now, when does a situation go from being an anti-government rebel uprising to actually being, if you like, a more organised civil war? I mean, we have in the East, Benghazi and around there, it seems to me the rebels are being described as the National Libyan Councils, one of the groups I've heard about. Is it getting to that point where they're that organized, they're going to wage a proper campaign?
Well, they have to do that organization, James, because it started again, like many of those rebellions or uprisings, as being leaderless, as being in countries which have experienced autocracy and a total lack of an infrastructure which would promote the institutions that would actually promote democracy. And therefore, in a sense, there was a vacuum. So I'm glad that they are organizing themselves so that they find somebody who represents them, what they want to achieve, how they want to achieve it, who's the address with whom we in the West, or actually the Arab League, could negotiate with. Those are very important issues, because if the rebels were left to their own devices, they're not all homogenous in the way they think, and then they would start fighting amongst themselves, and then they would then fight the Libyan army, and then there would be even more fragmentation in the country. And in a country that is quite strategic, quite oil producing, you would actually expose not only the region but us in the West as well to much, much more serious dangers. This is why, in a sense, it is important that this organization happens. But the attacks that have been actually happening these days at places like Misrata, places like Ras Lanouf, are places where there are oil installations or producing installations, and what the regime is trying to do is recapture those in order to strengthen its own resolve. But in a nutshell, James, a civil war, for me, as a definition, the most basic, simplistic definition, would be to say the country is divided, one Libyan is fighting against another.
Harry, let's move on slightly now, because we've talked, perhaps been on the borders of a civil war in Libya, is slightly different to the uprisings we've talked about before. I mean, some have clearly successfully ousted those dictators that have been in place for a long, long time. Talk to us a little bit about Jordan, about Bahrain. You mentioned off mic Iraq and Yemen, of course. I mean, there's still a lot going on here.
There is a lot going on. And one thing that's very important, James, and this is something that I've also learned as we've been doing those podcasts and as I've been doing various different interviews to other news organizations. At the beginning, I was also swept away by the euphoria that finally, after a slumber of almost a century, the Arab world had woken up and people power was acting again. Call me naive if you wish, but that naivete is also based on an earnest desire to see this area, which is so rich with its history and its heritage and its past achievements, regain its potential in the larger global system that we know today. But what has become clear is that you do not make revolutions overnight. Revolutions imply suffering, imply bloodletting, imply time. And even in places like Tunisia and Egypt, where to some extent we say that we've had bloodless as much as leaderless rebellions, uprisings, the presidents are certainly not in power anymore. Even there, there are serious dissensions and disagreements between different people as to where to lead the country and how to define the policies of the country, whether domestic or foreign. Now, insofar as the other countries are concerned, yes, Libya is perhaps now the focal point of many of our thoughts, especially if you go on Al Jazeera, whether the English language or the Arabic language channel, all you see every single minute of the day, you're being fed with breaking news and pictures of what's happening there. So you forget that in Yemen, there are serious, serious uprisings and demonstrations taking place against the president. And I think Yemen is in a very, very fragile state at the moment. Even in Bahrain, even in a relatively calm, relaxed monarchical system like Jordan, there are angry uprisings and demonstrations taking place there. If you look at other countries like Iraq, which we supposedly liberated from an autocrat some years ago, now if you go to places as far up as north in Kurdistan and as far south as Basra, but certainly in Baghdad itself, you see that there are people who are demonstrating as well. But those demonstrations, I think, are as much random as sporadic. People have suddenly realized that there is something called people power. So every grievance that they've had over the last decades suddenly is coming out to the fore, and people are saying it's time for us to go and demonstrate and right those wrongs. So in a sense, again, there is a difference in political analysis between tactics and strategy. Tactics, you respond immediately. Strategy is you think of the long term, and it's very important that we do that.
Now, I was going to ask you that, actually. Certainly, if you look to Iraq, a lot of post-conflict strategy that people are always criticising, well, saying that is completely missing. The one thing with a big momentum, a spontaneous uprising, is surely there's not a lot of planning as to what comes next. Your leader's gone. I mean, that was your aim, your principal aim, certainly. You want your lot to improve, but that strategizing, that sort of coordination isn't there, is it?
No, it's not. It's not really there, and that's part of the problem. But that's what you get from undemocratic countries who have been basically one man rules. And suddenly, if that man is no longer there, you've got the black hole that we've spoken about in previous podcasts, where if you do not fill it with another structure that could take care of your situation, then you risk being sucked into it. And if you get sucked into it, all hell breaks loose. So in a sense, much as I understand what is happening in all those countries, and much as I understand also our own Western lack of certainty as to what we should do and how we should react to everything. I mean, imagine if something happens in the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia, or if this goes even further, then it's not only a question of oil and regional security, then we are redefining a whole vision of what the Middle East is or looks like. So in a sense, we have to be very careful, and I'm just hoping that out of this, all this steam that is being let out, that gradually we would come to some sort of a cohesive structure that would help the peoples of the region first, and then secondly, their relations with the outside world.
Well, Harry, we're coming up to Lent, of course, now, and a time where you look at a profound sacrifice for mankind. Now, there's a lot of sacrifice going on in the Middle East, North Africa, to achieve a greater goal on behalf of the people here. You talked about, particularly in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, how Muslims, Copts, Christians, how they were standing side by side. And you've also talked on many occasions that how the sort of the heart of the people, both Christian and Muslim, is really to live in harmony and cooperation. Are we still seeing that now, particularly perhaps in Egypt, now the cameras have gone away?
Well, there are two answers to that, James. On the one hand, what I've also learned from speaking to so many people in those different countries over the past few weeks is that both Christians, indigenous Arab Christians, and indigenous Muslim Arabs have both had their own grievances against the regimes. So there was a common cause, a common purpose. And they united together for that common purpose, which is to change a regime which they considered, or regimes which they considered as being unjust, autocratic, and basically oppressed all their fundamental rights and their citizenship rights. Now that things are beginning to calm down in some of those countries, Egypt is an example where we are post the first stage, but entering a second stage in a multi-stage process. What is happening is that some of those tensions, religious tensions between the Coptic Christians of Egypt and the Muslims of Egypt, are beginning to erupt again. And when I say the Muslims of Egypt, I don't talk about the people in general. I talk about a small minority of people who are very, very conservative and Islamist in their agenda, and who basically do not accept Christians or people who are not of their own ideology, because I wouldn't even call this a faith, more of an ideology, the way they export their views. They sort of stoke up the tensions, and this is what has been happening last month in February, this month in March, in many places in Coptic churches, where there have been clashes, there have been demonstrations, and the army has not been able or willing, I don't know, to come in and restore order. So much as I was happy with this coming together in Tahrir Square, where Christians and Muslims were, the crescent and the cross were fighting together a common cause against injustice, I wouldn't want to see it backpedaling again to a situation when minority communities, particularly Christian minority communities, across the range of the Middle East, North Africa, would be subjugated again to the whims of a small group of fanatical extremists.
Now, our podcast is called Middle East Analysis, but I think it'd probably be fair to say we've been taken down a news agenda over the last 3 or 4 weeks. So what you've just reminded me of there are that there are plenty of things that we should be analysing in terms of the rights of the people, the exact situation right now. So perhaps when you get back, we'll delve a bit deeper as to exactly what lies underneath these headlines and the media pictures we're all seeing.
I think we should, James, because I believe that a lot of your listeners would be perhaps interested, and I hope they are, in sort of unraveling a little bit those issues that we have spoken of, as you justly mentioned right now, and perhaps looking at it a little bit more slowly, more patiently, in more detail, so that we can understand what's happening. And since this podcast will be posted on the Catholic Bishops Conference website, let me also say that perhaps a word of prayer and a word of remembrance should also be had by most of our listeners, yours and mine, not only to all the peoples of the Middle East and North Africa who are suffering grievously for the fighting that's going on there, but also a thought for the Minister for Religious Minorities in Pakistan, Shahbaz Bhatti, who was murdered when his car was ambushed by four extremists in Pakistan. He was a Catholic Christian who fought very strongly against the blasphemy laws in Pakistan that discriminated against Christians and Muslims alike, and he lost his life. So he is a courageous man, and the Holy Father spoke about him from Rome a couple of days ago, and there are even movements to declare him a martyr. So whilst we're thinking of our own Christian communities across the Middle East, North Africa, while we're thinking about the larger situation, let us also pray for this man who basically sacrificed his life at a very young age in order to defend the reality of a Pakistani society coming together rather than being divided and fragmented further.
Timely reminder there, Harry. I couldn't agree more. That's Dr. Harry Hagopian, Bishop's consultant on the Middle East and an international lawyer. And I appreciate you coming in, Harry, because I know you've been pushed from Pillar to Post, BBC, Al Jazeera. A lot of people want your time at the moment, so thanks for giving us some of it.
They do, but at the end of the day, this is one voice for the church, and we are all servants of the church.